The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
As the former director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at Penn and a professor there, she received many, many awards for her scholarship. The books are fascinating, many having to do with the presidency. Now, I should admit that those books interest me most, starting with my father, who coached me in writing to Franklin Roosevelt, urging him to run for a fourth term. But please, 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 don't spend time the rest of the evening trying to figure out my age, because you'll miss the whole speech. Of her voluminous work, I've loved several books, Dirty Politics and Double Bind, Women in Leadership. I could go on and on. Tonight's book, Echo Chamber, written with her colleague Joseph Capella, will interest all of us. Kathleen will explain the title. It talks about how the conservative media, led by Rush Limbaugh and the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, are the self-appointed guardians of the, quote, Reagan legacy. They are the attack dogs on liberalism in every single way. As Cass Sunstein, law professor at Harvard, says, the book is scary. Fasten your seatbelts. We're all in for an eye-opening experience. You may have seen Kathleen on the Bill Moyer Show, but here she is in person. I'm honored to present Kathleen Hall Jamieson.
Thank you. I'm fine. Thank you. I've been introduced by many people, but I've never been introduced by someone who is this close a friend. Thank you very much. And thank you to all of you for coming in from just a lovely summer evening to be inside. But if we're going to be someplace, this is a great place to be. I hope that we are all supporters of this fine institution in Philadelphia. I wanted to start by telling you that the book probably isn't what you would expect the book to be. And it certainly isn't the book that Joe Capella and I expected to write. If you'll think back to the early 1990s, 92, 93, conservative political talk radio was a pretty new phenomenon. And you were seeing covers of news magazines, and you were reading a lot in mainstream news about this very frightening new phenomenon. And we were reading about those things, too, and frankly, we weren't listening to conservative political talk radio as we were reading. When we began the study, we made the assumption, a naive assumption as it turned out, that those things may in fact be true, that routinely conservative political talk radio may be suggesting that ATF agents be shot with directions on how to do it most effectively. And certainly, that comment had been made on a conservative political talk radio show. We didn't know how typical it was, however. We'd also heard that Hillary Clinton had participated in the murder of Vince Foster. We thought it was a little odd that people would make those sorts of claims, but we also didn't know how typical it was that those kinds of claims were being made. And so we did a systematic analysis of what was then political talk radio, overwhelmingly conservative as it is today. And what we found was there certainly were extreme statements in political talk radio. But much of conservative political talk radio, as with the little swath of liberal talk radio, was pretty much sounding like what you're hearing in politics. Now, I don't mean to say that what we're hearing in politics is great civic discourse, or that you'd want to model your communication with your close friends on it, or if you did, that you'd sustain the relationship very long. But the reality was, as we coded hours and hours and hours, or I should say as the students coded hours and hours and hours, we found that those extreme statements were in fact atypical of a very large body of talk. And we looked back at what we know about the history of communication and said, perhaps that helps explain what's happening. Because it's been historically true that when a new medium emerges, the old media attack it as dangerous and scary and feature everything that sounds or reads as dangerous or scary in it. So perhaps the inference in the mainstream media that these extreme statements, and they did exist, were typical, and they weren't, was the natural reaction of the old media against a new upstart. Well, if that was intended to keep conservative talk radio down, it didn't succeed. Rush Limbaugh still has something in excess of 13.5 million listeners. It's a very large number. And since we began the study, there's a new kid on the block in cable television because Fox News has emerged and emerged during the time that we were studying. And in the process of doing the study, we'd actually missed the older kid on the block, the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. So let me fast forward a little bit to make this claim. The book doesn't say that talk radio and Fox News and the Wall Street Journal are unrequitedly evil or routinely extremist and uncivil. And as a result, it makes our liberal friends unhappy that we make that claim. On the other hand, we're not saying it's an unalloyed good, a great beacon of democratic discourse, and that will probably make our conservative friends unhappy. We actually see some good and some bad across the range of these media. Let me fast forward by asking you a question. I want to know how many of you listen to Rush Limbaugh. Okay? I want to know how many of you watch Fox News. I want to know how many of you read not the news page of the Wall Street Journal, but the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal. Now I want to know how many of you do all three. How many of you do all three? Listen to Rush, watch Fox, read the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. Now let me ask you on the other side. How many of you read the New York Times? How many of you watch MSNBC, CNN, listen to NPR, watch Bill Moyers, listen to Air America? Okay? I now can separate the conservatives from the liberals in the audience. Right? Now, notice what that says. Suppose we could gather up the people who have the pattern of media consumption that tilts toward the more progressive or liberal end, depending on your choice of words. And we could separate the people who are tending toward the conservative end. And suppose they didn't spend a whole lot of time watching and listening and reading to those things that are on the other side of the divide. What do you suppose happens when those people come to talk politics with each other? Well, I can tell you, first, what happens in this room, a lot of you are talking to each other. And those of you who are absorbing more from the conservative media stream are probably in most of those encounters with this group seeking out more conservative information from people who are more likely to share presuppositions. It just makes sense. Now, imagine that we reverse the numbers. Let's suppose that 95% of you were Rush Limbaugh listeners and or Fox News watchers and or Wall Street Journal editorial page readers. I can tell you some things about what you will know and how you will know them. And some of them, and that's the focus of this book, are very productive for politics. So let me start with my normative assumptions about what is productive for politics, knowing that 95% of you are probably actively hostile to the notion that there might be something good about the conservative media establishment, and you don't have a whole lot of experience of it, which means that whatever you've been told about it is not going to be contradicted by direct experience or reinforced by direct experience. Or, because once you're inside your own media enclave, and liberal progressives, you've got one, and conservatives, you've got one, you adopt those assumptions. They get reinforced. You don't question them. And if you find contradictory evidence, you're going to dismiss it or you're going to challenge it. In an earlier book called Unspun, which I wrote with Brooks Jackson, who with me coordinates factcheck.org, and this is my plug. I hope you're all subscribers. If not, I hope you will. We look at all the human tendencies that we bring to bear when we meet information that we don't like. We scrutinize it with real rigor. We challenge the evidence. We become highly analytic, and we're most likely to find a way to dismiss it. Now, what happens when the evidence is compatible with our own point of view? Well, we just accept it. The same rigor doesn't come to bear. Now, what's the difference between liberals and conservatives? Liberals believe they don't do that, and conservatives believe they don't do that. What do they have in common? They both do. It's basically a human tendency. It's how we process the world. But once we get locked into a media stream, some other things follow from that. And those are the things I'd like to explore this evening. I'd like to start by asking you some questions. I've already asked you the first question, which is, what do you listen to? What do you watch? Let's think about 2004. Okay, we're in the middle of the election season of 2004. So it's President Bush and it's Senator Kerry. Okay? 2004. And you hear this claim. President Bush's Social Security plan would cut benefits 30 to 45%. You hear another claim. President Bush wants to privatize Social Security. You hear another claim. President Bush favors outsourcing American jobs. You hear another claim. Vice President Cheney profited personally from Halliburton's contracts in Iraq. Okay, got those in mind? Liberals, you feel good? Conservatives? Those don't sound right to you, do they? Well, let's take some other ones. John Kerry did not deserve his Vietnam medals. Because of John Kerry, Senator John Kerry's statements against the Vietnam War in 1971, U.S. prisoners of war were tortured. Senator John Kerry said that every American soldier who served in Vietnam was a war criminal. Liberals, how you feeling now? Conservatives, how likely are you on each side to challenge the claims on the other side? Now, the claims that I've just read to you are actual claims from the 2004 election, and they were contested. So that means one side made the claim, and the other side said, that's just not true. Okay? Then there's some other claims in the election that weren't contested. Now, in my other job on factcheck.org, I would argue some of these are more factual than others. But that's not where I want to go with this analysis. These are things that are disputed in 2004. Now, there's some things that aren't disputed. There are such things as, how many troops do we have in Iraq? Basic background factual knowledge. So I want to separate 2004 into two different worlds. I want to have one world in which both sides fight about the fact. And the other world, whether it's factual or truthful or not, both sides fight about it. And the other, they don't dispute. They just grant it. So contested facts, uncontested facts. Okay? And into this world, I want to introduce the notion that some people are high consumers of Fox, of Rush Limbaugh. Some people are high consumers of New York Times, CBS, NBC, ABC, NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, NPR. So we've got these two different kinds of worlds. And through surveys, I can tell you that if you are consuming a lot of the so-called mainstream, you're more likely to accept the Democratic interpretation of the contested facts. And if you're consuming the so-called conservative mainstream, you're more likely to accept the Bush interpretation of facts. So when things are contested, what do those two different media streams do? They increase the likelihood that you get hunkered down inside one side's contested structure or the other side's contested structure. But now remember, we had a whole other domain of things out there. Those were the things that were uncontested. Well, I'll tell you something that the two groups have in common. Those people who listen to Rush Limbaugh, those people who pay attention to Fox, those people who pay attention to mainstream news, because they pay more attention. That's my inference. There's this association. And I'm going to say because, and if Joe Capella's in the audience, he's going to cringe and say you can't get causality out of a survey. But nonetheless, we've got this extremely interesting relationship between both of those groups and knowledge of the uncontested fact. So what does news consumption do? It increases your command of that uncontested world. And Rush Limbaugh does that, and Fox News does that, and CNN does that, etc. And so if we start from the assumption that paying attention to conservative media just dumbs you down a lot, or conservatives, paying attention to the so-called liberal media or the mainstream media dumbs you down a lot, in the non-contested facts, it just doesn't. And in the contested facts, in both cases, you begin to pull into your own ideological assumptions in politics. And that's the first finding of this book. Now, the implications of that for politics are interesting because you're more knowledgeable, and presumably that's good. But where things are contested, you're also more ideologically tagged. And that could be good, but it also could be bad if some of what you're getting is just wrong. Remember, I said you can actually make a case under that that some of this is closer to being true and some of it's closer to being false. And by the way, there's some of that on all sides of politics, although I don't want to get into relative numbers about where it is in which campaigns. But if we have a world in which increasingly we have the options to go to ideologically compatible media, and if we have a strong disposition to do that, then increasingly we're going to have polarized politics because we're not going to be able to find common ground in any area that's contested. And what's contested? Well, all the issues you care about that are going to translate into governance. So the positive side, increased knowledge, comes with a polarization that might make it harder to govern. There's something else, and now I'm going to limit to just the conservative media because that's the focus of the book and because that's the basis for the analysis here. We also know something that's very productive about what exposure to these kinds of media offers you. If you could think back to your history books about the 19th century, you'll remember a highly partisan political environment. Partisan newspapers, highly partisan campaigns, and levels of vicious, nasty attack that we actually haven't seen any time in our own personal memory. It was an extremely partisan time. It was also a time in which you had high levels of political involvement. And also, you appear to have an electorate that, as a result, was highly engaged in things that mattered to them. So there's some evidence from our history that high levels of partisan media, and that's the part of the partisan story I find most interesting, may actually help energize the electorate. It may get more people involved. Well, why would that be the case? Because if you get a high level of partisan content and it's coherent, you've got a structure for acting on politics that makes sense. You're not getting little fragments of stuff all over the place. You're not getting a lot of discrepant political information. And as a result, you probably have a coherent ideology, and you probably have a strong motivation to get involved to act on that ideology. Maybe the downside of this highly partisan media environment is polarization, and the upside is increased engagement, but in a more polarized fashion. And that's a mixed story. That's not a story that says it's an unalloyed good or that it's terribly bad. But I'll tell you something else that we found in our research. Even those of you who are high consumers on the right of conservative media are still picking up a lot of information from the mainstream. We're not as sure that the direction works the other way. But if what you're concerned about is, if you as a scholar, what you're concerned about is that what we have is a group that is just extremely hunkered down and never gets access to the other side, well, that's not true. In fact, Limbaugh listeners are more likely to view debates, and there you get two-sided communication, than are other conservatives in the presence of all the usual kinds of academic controls. The findings, by the way, that I told you about contested and uncontested facts are stronger for those who fit into these media patterns than for liberals or conservatives who don't. But those are tendencies under being liberal or being conservative, because they're basic tendencies about the way in which we communicate and the way in which we digest information. Let me tell you one more thing about how this kind of exposure works. Because if you're crossing over from, say, Limbaugh and Fox to pick up some CBS and some New York Times, and Limbaugh listeners were more likely to do that before Fox News. Now they're somewhat more likely to go to Fox News, but certainly not exclusively. But if that's the basic tendency, then part of what you are getting from that exposure is a coherent explanation of Reagan conservatism. That's what makes those three outlets coherent. And with it, certain presuppositions about how governance ought to work. And one of the interesting things about this is, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh across this long period of time and read the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and then when Fox comes in, you listen to Fox, and you knew nothing about Ronald Reagan or what he stood for philosophically and ideologically, you could piece it back in just by listening and attending to those outlets. It's that coherent. Now, progressives and liberals, you can't do that as well from your side of the aisle. But I will tell you something, and this is just a suggestion. How many of you are watching Keith Olbermann, Countdown with Keith Olbermann? Keith Olbermann is to the left what Rush Limbaugh is to the right. And all of the things that the left finds problematic about Rush Limbaugh, it finds charming in Keith Olbermann. So, for example, when Rush Limbaugh engages in ridicule, it's uncivil discourse. But with Keith Olbermann, it's sardonic humor. Mm-hmm. If you said, I'm going to try to take all the ideology away and I'm just going to look at how it works, funny, sarcastic, strong ideological attack, put up the other side in order to rebut it. Well, that's Olbermann. That's also Rush Limbaugh. The left, in the form of Olbermann, has found the Limbaugh formula. Rush Limbaugh does not sustain his audience without being a very skilled communicator who uses a broad repertoire to hold audiences over extended periods of time. If Rush Limbaugh were as, and I'm going to use this word deliberately, shrill, or as strident, or as hectoring, all those things we never say about men, but if he were all those things, as we might think he is from the left, he wouldn't have an audience. Who can imagine listening to 3 hours of something that would have those tags? And the same thing is true of Olbermann on the other side. So the left is beginning to create parts of its own structure. Take the editorial page of the New York Times, tie it to Keith Olbermann, and all you're missing is talk radio, and Air America is trying mightily. And just as Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and the Wall Street Journal provide access ways to each other and protection for each other. So Rush Limbaugh is published on the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal. When he's accused of doctor shopping for prescriptions, Fox emerges to provide time for his defender to defend him in public. When Roger Ailes is criticized, Roger Ailes, who helped produce the Limbaugh television show, short-lived Limbaugh television show, is criticized. He's heading Fox News. You get defenses in Wall Street Journal, you get defenses from Limbaugh. So that kind of self-protective relationship is there on the right. And you see access as a result. Well, people who are watching Olbermann, who is Rachel Maddow? Air America. So what the left has figured out is the synergistic formula that creates cross-promotion within its own structure. It just hasn't figured out how to get the audience for Air America yet. And I think that is because too many of its hosts are terminally earnest, but that's just my take on Air America. So if you say we now live in a world in which the left is trying to put the pieces together, the right has already figured out how to put the pieces together, what the left needs is the coherent ideology to push through those channels. And what you essentially have is a world in which we have a partisan media structure very much like that of the 19th century. Upside, engagement. Downside, potential polarization. Maybe more difficult to govern. On the other hand, you'd have more people buying in to the structure on the back end. What do each of those sides do? And I'll focus on the right because that's what we studied. What Rush Limbaugh, Fox News and the Wall Street Journal do is provide two forms of universal rebuttal. Two forms of universal rebuttal. First, if you read it, saw it, or heard it in mainstream media, and it causes you unease ideologically, it's untrue, because that's the liberal media, and what they do is distort conservatism. Now, I'm not making a claim about whether it's true or false that they do. This is a rebuttal. But if you come to the mainstream armed with the idea that if they tell you anything that runs counter to what you're disposed to believe, they're biased. They are the liberal media. Then you can move in and out of mainstream media and be unaffected by the things that run counter to your ideology. That's a universal rebuttal. And secondly, the mainstream media have a double standard. And the double standard goes like this. Trent Lott praises Strom Thurmond and implies that perhaps we would have been better off with a segregationist president. And what happens? I'm talking from the conservative perspective. What happens? The mainstream media comes up in arms and says that's completely unacceptable. Now, Fox, Rush Limbaugh, and Wall Street Journal all helped the move to make sure that Trent Lott did not reassume the position as majority leader. In the process, they helped protect the Bush presidency. Because if President Bush had come out against Trent Lott at the very beginning of that controversy, before he had all that protection with that very large audience, he might have alienated a conservative base. On the other hand, if he didn't come out against it, he might have alienated moderate Republican women. So there was a real problem for President Bush, and into that steps the conservative media, and they just navigate him right through that controversy because they take Trent Lott on. Then President Bush steps forward, his supporters step forward to basically push Trent Lott off, and they say President Bush is heroic. What he did was a wonderful thing. Now, that's not the double standard. The double standard goes like this. As they're defending Trent Lott, saying he's not a racist, but what he said is inappropriate, they are putting in place an argument that the mainstream is going after it when it doesn't go after its own kind, the liberals, when they say things that are comparable. And it's putting in place an argument that says that they forget that Republicans made it possible to pass the Civil Rights Act. True. They say Democrats have said things that are that awful, and nobody said a word. And they feature Robert Byrd, formerly a director of the Ku Klux Klan. Director is the wrong word, but I don't have the word in my head. The Ku Klux Klan, who uttered the N-word, actually, on Fox News. And what did the mainstream media, this is now conservative media, what did the mainstream do? Nothing. So what's the double standard? They go after our kind, the conservative, but they don't police their own kind on the same grounds. They're hypocrites, and they employ a double standard. If you can build up enough evidence of that kind of differential treatment, then when your conservative audience goes into mainstream and it thinks something is attacking conservatives, they can come back and say they're doing it because they're liberal, it's unfair, it may be untrue, and also they don't do the same thing with their own kind, and they build up a support base of evidence that deepens that perception. And every time another incident happens, the argument becomes a deeper argument with more evidence. What that ultimately should do is make the audience for Rush Limbaugh, Fox News, and the Wall Street Journal editorial page, because they have a common line of argument about these two, much less vulnerable to the frames from the other side, much less vulnerable to persuasion from the other side, because there's already a rebuttal structure in place. In academic terms, they've already been inoculated. We think that this is a complex and interesting phenomenon. We think it's the future. In an era in which we have many more media channels, it makes economic sense to have channels that try to reach smaller audiences than the mainstream used to get. And increasingly, the mainstream is getting smaller and smaller audiences. But smaller audiences than the mainstream used to get because they're large enough to produce a profit. And we have a commercial media structure. And as a result, we think the future looks like outlets emerging, tailored to ideological blocks, creating this kind of enclaving structure that ultimately may have both positive and negative effects for democracy, but nonetheless is something we're going to have to live with and deal with. So in summary, I know that 95% of you who raised your hands when I asked about New York Times, MSNBC, Bill Moyers, NPR, are very disappointed. I know those of you who raised your hand when I said Rush Limbaugh, Fox, are very disappointed because this is not a story that says this is an unalloyed good or it's an unalloyed evil. It's a complex and interesting phenomenon. And it has moments that are highly problematic. But you can find moments that are highly problematic over there on the other side of the ideological continuum, too. Depending on your ideology, you're just not likely to see them. I'd be happy to take questions. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you. I have a feeling we're going to have a lot of questions. A couple of ground rules. Limit it to one question, please. And you can't hear me? How about now? Please limit your questions to one question and phrase it as a question. Who would like to start us off? Right here, the fifth row back.
At one time, the Wall Street Journal had a fellow by the name of Hunt, I forget his first name, a so-called liberal journalist in the op-ed page. Now the New York Times has two conservative people, William Crystal and David Brooks. Can you account for that? I can't.
Which side do you want me to account for? Al Hunt's departure or the rise of Crystal and Brooks? Both. To the extent that elite media, and the Wall Street Journal is an extraordinarily fine business publication, whether it will remain so under the supervision of Rupert Murdoch is an open question at this point, but it's a very fine business publication, probably the best in the United States, talking about its news pages. If you want to increase the readership for that part of the newspaper, it makes sense that people who are not conservatives who are reading it find some place on the editorial page that is hospitable. There's very smart commentary on the op-ed pages of the Wall Street Journal. It is rigorously argued, it is carefully analytic, and it is not universally conservative now. So, for example, you will see people whom you'd identify, if you're conservative, as progressives or liberals, given space, but their voice is not going to be heard in the editorials. The editorials are going to hold to the conservative line. But as part of having an intellectually engaged op-ed page, you're going to hear those alternative voices. You'll also see very prominent members of the left who are arguing about legislation come onto the page to make the case for their legislation. So if there's not a regular editorial voice in the op-ed page, there is placement that is consistent enough to draw people who may be moderates or liberals, but reading the paper for its front pages to find some interest in the back pages. And what you ideally would like is people who start to read across ideology as a result, both ways. So you'd like to see people who are drawn to the Wall Street Journal for its editorial page and less attracted to its business pages coming over to see what the other side thinks in the New York Times. One of the difficulties in this enclaving tendency is it should minimize the likelihood that we make that move and, as a result, make it less likely that we understand where the other side actually comes from. Not because you don't hear the other side, but because you hear it in a refutative context. And so you don't get to hear it presented in its own voice as often as you might like if you want a comparative judgment. Now, New York Times on the other side, same argument. New York Times is watching, as are MSNBC and CNN, the emergence of a strong, economically viable niche market. Conservatives, on average, have more money. Conservatives, on average, are, as a result, a very attractive audience. And as a result, the New York Times would like to have them find some place that feels comfortable on their editorial pages, and being a good newspaper, would like to have some alternative views represented there as well, although the editorials themselves are going to be arguing not from the right but from the left. And so there's a business reason for both, to try to maintain a presence on each side. And the fact that that business motive is there increases the likelihood that there is some direct access to alternative points of view in both papers, which is very good news. Now, you notice I said MSNBC and CNN. Why is it that CNN has Glenn Beck? Same reason, right?
Tucker Carlson had a show for a while. Joe Scarborough has a show on MSNBC, former Republican congressman. What are they doing there? They're there to try to grab the audience drawn to Fox over to come on to CNN. And does Fox have some who are not self-identified as conservatives? It does. They're not the highest rated shows, nor are the liberal shows the highest rating. I'm sorry, the liberal shows are not the highest rated shows on Fox, nor are the conservative shows the highest rated on MSNBC and CNN. But nonetheless, the fact that they're there invites a kind of sampling that invites an audience to cross over. I mean, Greta Van Susteren, for example, regular show, basically non-ideological, but when she's ideological is not right, is probably moderate left. And people such as Susan Estrich are regular guests. She ran the caucus campaign on Fox. Why? To try to get some sense of balance, and also to try to increase the likelihood that you get sampling across channels. The place that you see the dominant voice is looking at Hannity and Combs. How many of you have seen Hannity and Combs? In theory, Hannity and Combs have a balanced show. In theory. But if you look at the framing at the beginning of each segment, it's framed from the right. And if you look at the basic personality dynamics, it's a little like saying, you may gather that I'm not the quietest person in the room, right? It's a little like saying, pick the quietest, most docile person and put me there and give us equal time. And guess what happens? Well, that's Hannity and Combs. Combs, among other things, is chronically polite, which makes it difficult to deal with Hannity, who's comfortable interrupting. And so when you have balance, you may attract people who want to hear Combs, but you're in a context that's going to privilege ultimately the ideological position of Hannity.
Another question. Lady in the sixth row here in black.
There's an intellectual reason as well as a business reason for having balance, right?
Yes. Yes.
My question is, you indicated that there is an increase in engagement. Do you have percentages to offer in view of the fact that, 50% of voters don't vote, don't engage?
When we first started with Limbaugh with the conservatives, because that was the phenomenon that was new. Then we picked up the Fox Channel, and then we picked up Wall Street Journal. So that's the order that we moved through. It's also the order we moved through because of the nature of the evidence we were able to gather. It's very easy for us, because we do large surveys, to find Rush Limbaugh's listeners. You've got 13.5 plus million of them. A survey will find them. It's more difficult to find the Wall Street Journal readers. In the 2 million range, there are fewer of them, so we're going to find them less often in a survey. And as Fox is building its audience, we increase the likelihood we can find them. So my strongest evidence is from Limbaugh. The Limbaugh audience is an audience that is more likely to vote. Okay? And when we first looked at the Limbaugh audience, the take in the mainstream media was, these are a bunch of lemmings, and they're being herded, essentially, by Rush Limbaugh. Or, there were all sorts of metaphors of that sort. They're sheep, and Limbaugh is just leading them off to the Republican, to the Republican side of the aisle. They're highly knowledgeable. They're highly educated relative to the rest of the audience. They're more educated than the rest of the audience. They're more white. They're more male. They're more likely to vote. They're more likely to be engaged. If by engaged you mean amounts of consumption of politics, we've got higher levels of consumption that correlate with the beginning move, which is coming into politics to start with to watch these phenomena. And so my assumption is that when you get those things put together, you've got a higher level of net engagement as you're able to increase those audiences. Can we make the argument in an absolute sense? No, because it's survey data, we can't get there. We can only get correlational data. But it's a reasonable inference from the pieces that we see on the table, including Limbaugh listeners are more likely to view presidential debates, which is counterintuitive. If you think they're more likely to avoid information from the other side, you'd say they're not going to watch presidential debates, which are two-sided. But it makes sense if you say, what are they doing? They're coming into root for their side.
Another question. Gentleman over here in the coat on our left.
I have a point similar to, I think, maybe the first point that was made on the other side, and that is I object strongly to your equation of the conservative media, such as Rush Limbaugh on the one hand, with MSNBC, for example. You also mentioned NPR. You mentioned the NewsHour, the major mainstream networks, and so on. All of those are liberal, you say, as opposed to conservative on the other side. I listen to MSNBC every night for hours. Yes, there is Keith Olbermann. He's for 1 hour. Then there's Chris Matthews for 2 hours. His program is repeated. Chris Matthews is relentlessly...
Sir, do you have a specific question you'd like
yes.
to ask?
Yes. There is nothing liberal in general about MSNBC and nothing very much that I can see liberal about CNN. They are studiously balanced or impartial. And you compare that with Rush Limbaugh, and I think that's a false comparison.
First, the impression I've left you with means that my argument is not sufficiently nuanced. So let me try again. The evidence that we see from our survey, which is where I'm starting, suggests that when you look at the contested claims, the people who are listening to MSNBC, to those kinds of programs, are controlling for ideology more likely to accept the Democratic position. So we've controlled out what should be producing it, and we've controlled out education and the other things that should be producing it. The same is true on the other side with Limbaugh and with Fox. Now, you don't have to call it liberal, but the Democratic contested claims are more likely to be believed in those audiences. The Republican contested claims are more likely to be believed on the other side. I haven't described any content at all at that point. I'm simply making the case that the audience winds up at a different place on the contested claims, at the same time as its base knowledge moves up about the uncontested claims. I'm not trying to make a claim about whether everything on that side is liberal or not. That's not my intent. My claim about Olbermann is that if you look at what makes Olbermann successful, stripping out the ideology, the underlying structure that he uses is parallel to the structure that is used by Limbaugh. That is, he inoculates. He frames from the left and rebuts against the right. He features guests who are going to reinforce that position. He uses humor, and he uses, for example, Bill O'Reilly's name is not Bill O'Reilly on that show. It's Orally or it's O'Reilly. Well, Limbaugh does the same kind of thing on the other side. So the underlying structure there is an entertaining structure, stripped of ideology, that lets him build his audience. That audience is building. That's not a claim about whether he's liberal or conservative, although I believe he's liberal. It's a claim to say that there's a fundamental structural similarity in what he's doing, and it is attracting an audience. Would I make the claim that all those things that produce that effect are liberal? I don't know what the definition of liberal is at this point, and so I don't know how I'd make the claim. I can make the claim that it's different from what Limbaugh offers because it is not championing Reagan conservatism. It's more disposed to see government as a solution, for example, than is Rush Limbaugh. So I can build up an inferential case that it is different, whether you call it progressive, whether you call it liberal, whether you call it mainstream. I'm more comfortable calling it other. So that's the claim that I'm trying to make, and if I simplified it, that was my mistake.
A few more questions. Third row right here, lady in red.
You talked about contested and uncontested facts. Can you give an example of uncontested facts?
Yeah. I mean, one of them is how many troops were there in Iraq? Kerry was a prosecutor. John Kerry was once a prosecutor. Uncontested fact. John Kerry wanted to pay for the $87 billion allocated to the Iraq War by eliminating part of the Bush tax cut for those paying the highest income tax rate. Uncontested fact. That is, the other side didn't contest the truth of it. When in Congress, current CIA head Porter Goss supported cuts in spending for intelligence. Uncontested fact. The Bush administration discovered the flu vaccines were contaminated and decided to stop their distribution. Now, on each of these, there's a true or false answer about what is and is not contested. But uncontested fact. The United States has found weapons of mass destruction. Those two we code as being false, but they're uncontested. People are more likely to get the answer correct. So we believe the correct answer to Kerry was once a prosecutor is true. We believe the answer to Kerry wanted to pay for the $87 billion allocated to the Iraq War by eliminating part of the Bush tax cut for those paying the highest income rate is true. We believe that when in Congress, current CIA head Porter Goss supported cuts in spending for intelligence is true.
Those people who are the media consumers on each side that we've studied are more likely to get the things that are true, true, and false, false. They're not picking an ideological tact on it. Now, you could have contested any of these. And a classic example in 2004 concerned unemployment. I mean, many facts are contestable. What you thought about unemployment was a function of whether you used the payroll survey or the household survey. And each side used the survey that benefited its own case. Okay? So essentially, they contested the claim of the other side by going to a different survey. It became a contested fact. So it's not that you couldn't have contested these. They become uncontested for us because the other side didn't contest them. And there the background knowledge goes up.
Another question. About six rows back, gentleman with his hand up.
Is it fair to say, looking at the domestic scene, the Democrats on one side being reinforced by various aspects of the media, the Republicans being reinforced, and so they really can't get together because they just can't get together. There's a block there. So can that same principle be applied to the United States and the rest of the world? In other words, we hear what we want to hear, and as soon as someone from outside this country says something that maybe is not in line with what we believe, then all of a sudden they're cast out.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
And you can say that of other countries as well. I mean, the nationalistic filter is as strong as the ideological filter. And it's got a whole lot of structural support under it.
Lady in the corner here.
Hi. Could you speak about the Comedy Channel and Stephen Colbert, Jon Stewart, and the impact that their so-called news shows, or maybe even Saturday Night Live, have on general public, but particularly on the youth?
One of our doctoral graduates, his name is Dana Goldthwait-Young, wrote her dissertation on this and did it based on evidence from the National Annenberg Election Survey, which is the largest survey the academic community does of the electorate, and it's run at the Annenberg Public Policy Center. And as a result, when there was the contest in 2004 in which a person on the conservative end, Bill O'Reilly, accused the listeners, whether in jest or not, for the Daily Show of being, I think it was stone slackers, or something like that. We had evidence that let us compare the base knowledge of the people who are in his audience and the base knowledge of the people who are in the Daily Show audience, controlling for education. And what we found was you've got a high level of base knowledge in the Daily Show audience. Now, the Daily Show is coming from the left, not the right. Does anybody want to dispute that? Okay. The Daily Show employs humor. It employs irony. It's a very sophisticated rhetorical move. In the process, it does some of the most devastating media criticism I have ever seen or read. I think the piece that they do about the weather reporters in hurricanes deserves to be immortalized as a classic of the 21st century. And after seeing that, when a news director sends the people out into the hurricane, I hope that person is thinking, if you see signs blowing around the background and if you see the person practically being swept out to sea by the hurricane, don't do that because you're going to be parody on The Daily Show as being completely irresponsible. They also are extremely effective, much more effective, I think, than the standard media critic at editing together things that help you see things in a different way. And the level of humor is extremely sophisticated in some of those segments. And in some segments, it's just so basic it looks like old vaudeville. But what it does that I think makes it work for its audience is it combines a high level of news content with a high level of humor, and as a result, is highly engaging. I think the toughest interview on television for a book author is an interview with Jon Stewart if he disagrees with the ideology of the book. And that's 15 minutes of very intense intellectual engagement. The other thing that we've observed about The Daily Show, and we first observed it about Saturday Night Live, was that you have to put the predicates of humor in before people will laugh. So if they don't get the assumptions underlying the joke doesn't work. And as a result, they put in place a reasonable amount of political information. And it's accurate political information. That's the interesting thing. It's accurate political information. We were studying the healthcare reform debate in 93, 94, And the health care reform debate in 1984 was just a mess. There were 7 bills on the floor. The press was having trouble keeping them straight. So it was the Clinton bill versus the bill of the week on the other side. And we had elaborate charts to try to keep track of which bill advocated what. And Saturday Night Live did a skit in which, in 3.5 minutes, they laid out the distinctions across 3 of the major bills better than news had done and better than we had been able to do with all of our charts and graphs. And they got people to laugh. And so the capacity of humor to deliver accurate political content is actually very high. And the one characteristic of 19th century politics was it was fun. And one characteristic of academics who write about politics is we make it sound as if we want to lock you in a room and force you to watch PBS. And to the extent that we're going to engage people in politics, probably putting some of the humor and some of the fun back in it is a really good idea.
A few more questions. Gentleman in the gray about 10 rows back.
Thank you. Could you explore a little of the nuance when it comes to newspapers, the Times and the Journal? Those criteria that you use to assess advocacy in television, could you apply to the Times and the Journal and kind of distinguish or liken the two in terms of degree of advocacy in the editorial pages?
It would be a really interesting study, and no, I can't do it. We've spent a lot of time looking at the Wall Street Journal. We were not making a direct comparison to the editorial page of the New York Times. The scholarly community for the last 30 years has essentially been studying what we ordinarily would call the mainstream. And so there is a lot of research about how the various newspapers function. There's a lot of disagreement about the extent to which there is or is not an ideological bias in them. That's not a literature that's at all clear. And because I haven't done that direct comparison, I'm not comfortable giving you an answer.
And the question, lady in the white right here.
Okay. This question doesn't exactly pertain to your book, but I'm just looking at this audience, and you talked about new media. I teach, and my students do not read newspapers. That's dead media. That isn't even, that's just non-existent media. So they don't care about the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. You haven't mentioned the Internet, and I was just wondering, have you seen any sites on the Internet that have started to carve out a niche left and right that people are really paying attention to that you notice your students reading?
Yeah, when people in general tell us they're not reading newspapers, we're not sure they're correct about that because there's a lot of reported time online going to portals that are news paper-based portals. And when you come through Google, if you pick up the Google News, you're getting a summary of major newspapers as part of that structure. And so we're trying to get a handle on this, and I wish I could give you a good answer. But what we're trying to do with the National Anti-Berg Election Survey is to get people to focus on what they do when they're on the Internet, because they don't think they're reading a newspaper, and then they'll tell us that they go to CNN.com. Well, they may not think they're reading a newspaper. They're reading something that's news-like. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the major newspapers have attracted sizable web audiences. They just haven't figured out how to make that web audience commercially viable as a way to sustain the business of the newspaper. So we have a suspicion that the younger audience is, in fact, consuming more news in a non-traditional form that is produced by what we used to call newspapers and what we used to call news than they actually think they are. And let me segue off to something else that has nothing to do with this book, but I think is potentially very interesting. What we see in the National Anti-Berg Election Survey this year is a very high amount of talk within Democratic households across candidates. And so the phenomenon that media have described anecdotally as the young are trying to persuade their parents to vote for Obama, or the grandparents are trying to persuade, or the husband's trying to persuade the wife, we actually see in the survey. And when you've got people within the immediate household who disagree, now we're studying the Democrats because the Republican primary wasn't producing this kind of a phenomenon as far as we could see. When you've got one person supporting Senator Obama, one person supporting Senator Clinton, they are talking to each other about the candidates. They're trying to make a case to the person on the other side. And out of that clash is coming information searching on the Internet. And out of that searching, and this is correlational, not causational, but out of that searching appears to come higher knowledge. So when you have people talking, supporting different candidates on the Democratic side, more talk, you usually get less. Usually one person falls silent. So more talk, not less, more searching on the Internet, and higher knowledge scores. Since many of the people in this study who have this phenomenon are young, that suggests to me an information search structure that lets them go to something that I would call news, although not wrapped in traditional form, because how else is their knowledge level going up? One more thing. We did a survey a couple of years ago that asked people who they thought a journalist was. So, because we say journalist, and essentially what is news, we found widespread agreement that network anchors are journalists. We found less agreement that Chris Matthews is a journalist. We found about a third of the audience saying Rush Limbaugh was a journalist. Rush Limbaugh responded to that finding by saying that he's not a journalist. Thank you for joining me tonight. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.